sorry.
Right, I will reconvene the hearing.
Mr. Robinson.
Apologies for the people at the back who, I gather, haven't got a good hearing for me. Try and juggle all of us now. Mr. Winchester, you've set out in the submissions the reason why you don't think it's a good idea to put into Chapter 1, in effect, a snapshot of what is in and what is out of the plan. Effectively because, as I read your submissions, effectively because it's going to change. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, it is. And also because it won't really assist people who ultimately use the plan. That historical aspect just simply won't be relevant in due course.
And you make a fair point that there would need, we need to find jurisdiction to amend Chapter 1. The question I put to you for your consideration is, well, given that there is already a snapshot of what is in and what is out of the plan in Chapter 27.3.3.1, would there be any difficulty in shifting that forward? Clearly that wouldn't have jurisdictional problems, and it might be slightly more obvious to the reader.
Well, I'm not sure what the submissions are about relocating parts of the proposed plan to other parts. But in terms of the content, one might say it's minor and administrative rather than substantive. I haven't picked up that particular issue, sir. Obviously, read the plan chapters more closely than me. Congratulations for getting to chapter 27.
Eyes were blazing over at that point, I have
to. Well, look, at a conceptual level, I don't see an issue, sir.
Right, in terms of your description of chapter 1, not having regulatory impact. Can you explain to me what the role is of section 1.7.6 about putting poles, identification poles? Because that seemed to be the exception. That seems to have regulatory effect.
Sentence does
say the council may request.
Shouldn't there be, if the council's going to have something like that, that it's suggesting the council has an unfettered discretion to require polls? Shouldn't, if the plan is going to suggest those things, shouldn't there be some limitations on that discretion and indications of when and where it will be used? I mean, arguably, there will be many cases where it's not a matter that you could ask for the information under Section 95. And on the other hand, as a commissioner who sits on resource consent hearings regularly, it is a very helpful thing in many cases, although not always, to be fair.
Well, I suppose the question that arises out of that is whether you actually shift this requirement and make it a requirement, or but it does seem to sit naturally here as as a process-based important piece of practical information.
Well, I agree it's a practical and important piece of process information, but I think the other problem the council perhaps has got itself into in this belief that all information requirements are contained in the Act is has ignored the fact that inevitably some types of consent application or some locations will have different requirements from others, which we know about in advance. And there are even simple matters like it would be very useful if the plan specified the scale of maps so that we don't get plans at scales which are very difficult to understand. I know that the council uses electronic systems, so for the officers it's no problem. The rest of the world who still relies on paper and scale rules, it's very unhelpful to have a plan at 1 to 3.5, for example.
Yes, well, I suppose my response to that, sir, and you have the opportunity to put those questions to a council officer, is whether it is necessary to get into that level of detail in this chapter, first of all, secondly, whether it's going to do so. But I certainly don't read this particular clause as giving an unfettered discretion to the council to require that information. It says council may request it. It doesn't mean that the contestant government direct polls. Potentially,
I think the reality is, Mr. Winchester, if the council requests it and the applicant doesn't direct the polls, the council will not process it any further until they are erected. I think that's the reality of the circumstances that we're dealing with.
My understanding of there are submissions in here where people have drawn to our attention the fact that some of these polls seem to have been left in place for some considerable time. And my question was, what if the polls and they're all connected, do they fall within the, do they become a structure in terms of definition and things like that? And I just wondered how, if you could come back to us in terms of how that could sit there within this part of the plan as an information requirement,
those sorts of
matters.
Wasn't there also a submission, actually, I think it might have been the same one, where they'd been left up for a considerable time, but they weren't actually relative to a resource consent. They were just apparently polls that were put up without a resource consent application, and so that is another consideration.
One issue for you to consider is that is erection of poles of this kind permitted activity in all zones?
Understood,
sir. And I think to add to that, there is a further submission suggesting that there is an existing rule that I didn't check in the operative plan requiring the poles and that a similar rule should be carried forward. I think it was in the rural general zone they were referring to. But it may be. But I know that in practice, they are used in all the rural zones, including rural living in Gippsland Valley. So that does go wider than just the rural general zone at the moment.
Thank you, sir. I understand all those questions. I don't have the answers at my fingertips.
Could I add another part of them as well? If it is a rule, and on the face of it appears to be a rule, because it's requiring something or may require, and either one way or the other, but then there should be an objective and policy that it's giving effect to. So you might like to just consider that as part of the mix too.
Yes, and I suppose that does raise an issue as to whether, one, what this clause is, two, where it lives, But no, I understand what you're saying. I would simply repeat my earlier submission, and I fully accept the panel's experience and possibly others in the room as to what the practice is, but it does say may request, say may require, and in my submission there'd be some difficult issues about council requiring that as a means of assessment.
And to add to the things that you might ponder, can I suggest you think about whether if the clause states a discretion whether to have them at all, it might also state a discretion as to how long you have them. Because at the moment it's phrased in mandatory language. The second half is phrased in mandatory language. But moving right along, I want to talk to you about goals. In effect, what are they? In terms of the list of mandatory and discretionary components of a district plan, where do the goals that is currently suggested in Chapter 3 fit? I think Mr. Pates has made a suggestion that there are anticipated environmental results. What's your view?
Well, they don't neatly fit into any of the statutory language. They're certainly discretionary aspects of the plan. I think they're possibly a mixture of objectives and issues. As to whether the label is important, that's a matter for you. So the district plan must say objectives, policies and rules. Certainly objectives are included, they flow from the goals. So I think the best way of characterising them is a statement, a mixed statement of issues and environmental results anticipated.
Do you think it might be helpful to say that in the introduction to Chapter 3 to avoid future argument?
It anticipates, sir, but from my perspective, I don't see any problem with that.
Well, and what about in regard to, you might just answer this, but in regard to when a decision maker is making decisions under 104 and they look at the objectives and policies in particular, how would, in terms of directing the decision makers, how are the goals fit within there? Is it something that they should be looking at when it's a non-compliant activity? How do you see that working?
Well, if you look at section 104.1b, you're required to have regard to any relevant provisions of a plan or proposed plan. They're plainly a provision. And their relevance will be determined by the facts and circumstances of an individual application. At section 104D stage, particularly for non-complying activities, the statutory language directs you to objectives and policies, and I don't think that would extend to goals, and nor should it.
You've clarified for us, in your view, an issue, a mix of an issue and an objective.
I said it that a mixture of an issue and an environmental result of discipline.
So in terms of from a planning perspective, it might be that goal objectives are environmental outcomes sought, or a goal, I'm particularly thinking about things phrased within the quality plan website information there. And what I'm trying to understand, to better understand, is what's the difference between a goal and an objective. Clearly, and to have it, if there is a difference, to have it set out in the plan so that it can be quite clear to everybody and to decision makers when they're considering applications.
So I think that's probably quite helpful, because certainly see down the track debates about whether goals are being achieved or not with individual applications, and if that is not an express statutory test, then it does test the course of administration issues and potential for debate, which is probably unhelpful.
Are you, Mr. Winchester, are you familiar with the Environment Court decision from last year, Ngāti Kahu and Hawke's Bay Regional Council?
Is that the Anders & Overs case?
Yes. I raise it not for the Anders & Overs, but it's the only one that I'm aware of where the court has actually come to a conclusion as to what an objective is. And the court said, and it's probably worth reading this out while you're still worth talking about goals, because it said, the concise Oxford is simple and direct. An objective is a goal or aim. That simplicity sits perfectly well here. An objective in a planning document sets out an end state of affairs to which the drafters of the document aspire, and is the overarching purpose that the policies and rules of the document ought to serve. Now, with that use of the term, doesn't that make goal and objective synonymous?
Some of these goals are not necessarily written as objectives in practices.
Well, I have to say, most of the objectives aren't written as objectives in the planning sense, so we'll get to that eventually. So let's deal with the goals first,
yes.
Though.
Well, look, I take no issue with the environment for this analysis.
Is it possible, in a legal sense, for a district plan to have very high-level objectives, which have a very broad application, which it may term goals, and beneath that have the more explicit objectives or outcomes for the variety of things that fit under that broader and overarching objective?
Absolutely, sir. It is. And while it's not binding on this panel, certainly it's an approach that has been adopted with the Christchurch Replacement District Plan. I don't think any party there took issue with the ability of high-level strategic objectives to be set, to which more specific lower-level objectives and policies
I just wanted to understand you have some experience in Christchurch. Just in terms of, and because this has been raised in some of the evidence and submissions where people have drawn our attention to that, is it that under, how is it that those strategic objectives in terms of that Christchurch, in terms of the independent panel in terms of their decisions, would they be included as something that you would consider under 104 as objectives and policies in a... Just if you can enlighten us around that?
Well, they are objectives of the plan. So they are intended to have overarching effect and considerable weight when it comes to Section 104 and in particular 104D. To an extent as well, they have been used by the panel quite consciously as a guide to drafting or a direction in terms of drafting of lower order, more specific chapters, in that they use to test those lower order chapters and more specific issues as to whether they're actually achieving those higher order goals. And again, no one has raised a question of law about that or taken that matter to the High Court.
And how does that situation relate to the one before us regarding the lower order chapters that we're looking at relative to the strategic ones that we're looking at now?
I don't think it's certainly in the way that the plan as notified is structured. It's not as explicit. But that's not to say that it can't be within the scope of submissions. And certainly you read Mr. Pates's report where he has given that matter specific consideration because it has been raised in submissions. And as to an internal hierarchy, and, you know, my submission is that that's available. And secondly, that if the strategic chapters are to have the influence that they're intended, it's probably sensible as well. And could be more explicit. But again, you put those questions to the relevant ones in terms of the merits.
And in terms of the structuring, there's an obvious danger that if you have too many layers, you end up with multiple ways of saying the same thing and potential inconsistencies. Although it's strictly a planning issue, do you have a view about, is simplicity an objective that we should strive for? If there are too many layers, assuming this jurisdiction, should we contemplate collapsing them together?
Understand there is jurisdiction, and is simplicity a goal? Well, I think that then takes you to Section 32. And it's certainly a factor, I think, that flows from Section 32 around efficiency and effectiveness. And it is efficiency and effectiveness of plan provisions that it's talking about. How they actually work, how they're administered, the sort of costs and benefits that they provide. So I think simplicity is embedded within Section 32, my submission.
Can I sort of interrupt? Because there's actually, just going back to the structure of strategic directions and the question of goals, I'd like to go one up from there, and that's back into the purpose. In which the special qualities of the Lakes District are identified. And wondering if these should actually be strengthened so that they are referred to more, because currently they rely on the goals, objectives and policies to elaborate on them. But I don't see how we actually come back, if there's a visual consent, is there any way that people, that the planners, commissioners come back and look at those special qualities and say this is actually what we're trying to sustainably manage? And I don't see that. It might just be ignorance, but is there a better way to ensure that those special qualities don't just get named in the purpose and then forgotten about?
Well, I suppose the answer to that is whether you make them into some of the parts of the plan or you transform them into parts of the plan that you have to include. has to include objectives, policies, and methods. At the moment, these are provisions, provisions of, well, they're discretionary things to include in the plan. To the extent that they don't necessarily, or they haven't been couched as being other explicitly discretionary parts of the planning document, and that there are a mixture of issues, again, and a mixture of environmental outcomes anticipating them. Dramatic alpine landscapes, free of inappropriate development, is an anticipated environmental outcome. As is clean air and pristine water. In fact, they're all outcomes.
They're pretty much all outcomes. So should, I guess, if we're looking at goals, objectives and policies, is that, are these qualities something that should actually become goals or whatever the definition becomes?
Well, they would carry greater weight in an assessment if they were characterised as objectives because of the statutory language in Section 104 and 104D.
Is it necessary for an objective to actually have the title objective in front of it to be an objective in law?
Yes. I would want it to be an objective. I wouldn't want there to be debate about it because, if we were looking at these purposes here in 3.1, for example, and having a debate about that before the courts, I would say if they were characterised as anything, they would be anticipating environmental outcomes. And therefore, in a Section 104D analysis, not necessarily strictly relevant as a test against what you're proposing as a test.
But then again, on the decision of Judge Thompson's, the anticipated environmental outcome is, to use his terms, an objective.
And I
raise this because in Frankton Flats A zone, which was brought in by the court some years ago, only has a purpose, but the decision of the court talks about the objectives and policies being included. I don't want to go into detail about it, but and there it could only be referring to the purpose because there was no other documentation they could be referring to. I'm just wondering whether the titling of things is important, or is it what they mean is important?
Well, I think you probably need to put that to planning witnesses as to how they, for example, would go about doing their analysis. I think the description and the title is important because if it actually says these are objectives, then that's what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no debate about it. Whereas if you've got an overarching purpose, do you then measure the listed objectives against the purpose and incorporate it that way? You get an additional layer of qualification on the objectives by reference to those sort of high-level goals and the purpose, and if so, do you risk making an error of law?
In that case, then, is the jurisdiction change the term goal to objective?
And then what do you do with the objectives that are called objectives? Do they become something else?
There are some submissions that I'm aware of that talk about the lack of clarity and raise question marks as to what some of the language is intended to achieve. And so the issue is clearly not. It's then a question as to how far you would go in your recommendations in terms of the restructure to achieve possibly better clarity, which you consider it necessary, as to whether that cross the line into something that's beyond scope.
Related to that, Mr. Winch, is that in terms of the purpose and in terms of how that part of 3.1's title is purpose legally would be looking at, is that something similar to an identification of issues within the plan? Or is it something different?
No, as I said, I think looking at the categories of discretionary matters that a district plan can include in section 75.2, some of them you could say they're significant resource management issues for the district, possibly. I think the better way of characterising them, given that they're quite outcome focused, is under 74.2d, which refers to the environmental results anticipated from the policies and methods. So these are outcomes that the plan is trying to achieve through the implementation of policies and methods. But interestingly, when you look at what 74D talks about, it only talks about policies and methods. So are they objectives? It's
our environmental outcomes included as part of the objectives?
Yes. Yeah. And the inference from that statutory language is that they are.
Sorry, can I clarify my understanding of that? So you're saying anticipated environmental outcome becomes a subset of objectives as opposed to a different descriptor. So you could have anticipated environmental outcomes under which there are specific objectives. So in fact, anticipated environmental outcomes could take over from the word of goal. Would that make sense?
Yes, and I think your question is a good one, Commissioner, and that section 75.2 talks about the discretionary matters that you can include in the district plan. And it seems to be more related to non-regulatory matters. So it talks about issues for the district, the methods other than rules for implementing the policies, principal reasons for adopting the policies, the environmental results expected from the policies and methods, etc. So it doesn't necessarily talk directly about objectives, because you must have objectives. But I think what I was saying is that the inference from 75.2d, it talks about environmental results expected from the policies and methods. Policies and methods, as a matter of law, must achieve objectives. So that does indicate a strong relationship between objectives and environmental results anticipated. And look, I must say, I've never had the need to go down to this level of forensic analysis of the statutory language of section 75,
we're pleased to give you some new work.
Oh, that's exciting for me. Really.
That's really sad to say, Mr. Winchester.
I think that it does highlight the importance of clarity, in that these purposes are effectively environmental results anticipated. But you probably, for the sake of clarity, would want to better link them to the objectives. And then you get probably a more direct thread flowing through those provisions, which then would assist planners and plan users in applying those provisions, particularly those threshold tests in section 1.4d.
Mr. Winchester, could I add to the third request, just in terms of, from my memory, anticipated environmental results were under the Act, before it was amended one of many times, it was actually included in there as a list that you did have to have in there from memory anyway. And I wondered whether there was any assistance in terms of, I know, papers by any feet or that kind of thing, where it talked about that there was maybe some confusion for people between what the anticipated environmental outcome was and what the objective is, which is why they might put it together. My purpose for asking that is how does that all relate to, as you just said, making it quite clear within the chapter what the parts are when you're doing the 104 assessments, so it's quite clear which bits and how much weight should be applied to them or how it is structured in here.
Look, I haven't, well, probably have read some of those MFN papers. I understand the rationale to be somewhat simpler than that, which was that there was a concern, whether it was from MFE policy people or indeed Dr. Smith as the minister, that plans were becoming enormous and unwieldy, and that, you know, why don't we go back to old-fashioned plans that were much more simple, much more slimline? Mm-hmm. So let's just include the true operational bits to avoid that level of debate. And if you look at the changes to Section 75 to make parts mandatory and other parts discretionary, I believe, but I'm not entirely sure, that coincide with changes to Section 32. So what you were actually doing in terms of Section 32 was doing an express analysis of those mandatory parts of the plan as to their effectiveness and efficiency, rather than necessarily having to go further to look at those broader provisions that weren't mandatory. But certainly, as I understand it, all of the matters included in Section 75.1 and 75.2 used to be mandatory.
Well, can we change the subject to the of Tāngata Whenua? I think I want to talk to you about your paragraph 6.32, where you're here responding to an argument for Michael's Park and Queenstown Park about, I think it's section 545 and not 558, but that's by the by. These are this is the objective for management and protection of Waitupuna. And you're saying, and the concern in the submissions is they're not mapped, and they should be, in order to determine whether those are appropriate objectives and policies. And your response is that map 40 shows the three tōpuni that are referenced in that section. And the underlying assumption, it seems, from my reading of your 6.32, is that the tōpuni on map 40 are Waitupuna, first of all, do you have any evidence for that? Because they're defined separately as distinct terms in the glossary of the Tāngata Whenua sections. I thought I'd give you the chance. I do intend to ask the Tāngata Whenua witnesses to clarify from why benefit.
That was my assumption.
And taking this assumption, if the assumption is borne out by the evidence, do you think it would be appropriate that the objective and the policies should be more specific, that those are the three sites that objective and policies, those policies refer to?
Well, I think you should ask the question of Mr. Pickard, but my understanding is that there are more to be identified. So this is an incomplete list at the moment. It's up to at this point in time. It is up to Tucker Fenua to identify and advise the council on additional areas and for them to be included. So that's my understanding. And if that's the case, then I don't think it would be appropriate for the executive policies to refer specifically to the three identified ones at this stage.
And following that train of thought, if and when in stage two a greater or lesser number of Wai Tupuna are then mapped, would submissions on the objective and policy as related to those additional sites then be out of scope because those that objective and those policies had all been settled in this process?
Well, I see the objective and policies as being about the management framework and the policy approach. And those subsequent matters are really around location and values. I suppose to the extent that possibly identified values aren't appropriately recognised in objectives and policies, there may be scope to revisit those issues.
Where would you see those values sitting?
I think they should appropriately, to the extent that they are important values, probably should sit in the objective policy framework.
In the policy frameworks. Do you see that as being addressed in the stage, or do you see that, because I notice it's not referenced over into stage two, where do you see that actually being addressed and how?
I suppose it's hard to address now because of the limited number of tupuna that have been identified, and so it's difficult to prejudge or predetermine or look into the future as to what other values might be identified. To the extent that new issues or values are identified, it would probably be appropriate to take another look at what's in the Tangapenua chapter from a policy perspective and make sure that if necessary it is updated.
May I?
Yes.
Given that, one of the things I also noticed too was that, I'll use heritage as an example, that there, I could not find a definition throughout the plan. Like I actually did the exercise of looking at the operative and the proposed in terms of Tangata Whenua and put them all down to see as to what has been addressed and what's been missed out in terms of the state. And it's interesting, under the definitions, I was unable to find a definition of historic, except within the Act, given that it's within the Act, that if you're looking at those values and that it's within a policy area, would it be prudent to look at a definition of historic, so within those chapters those values are picked up, given that it could be date related?
The definition of historic heritage in the Act is
pretty clear in terms of saying the heritage values.
Yes.
So, however, for the definition and interpretation, when it comes to those values and being quite clear, so given the definition of the Act, what is your view that it is defined to imply to include cultural, i.e. Ngāi Tahu, pre a defined date, or is it indeterminate in terms of the Act? I'm going to ask the same question about landscape, cultural landscape as well.
The Act doesn't place a limit on a time limit. It will make it time related as far as cultural matters is concerned, which is quite different from the Historic Places Act, which I think historic places were areas that were in existence or late pre-1900 matters in terms of archaeological authorities. That is a much broader definition here. And you know, that's borne out by the fact that heritage items can be as recent as the 1970s when it relates to specific architectural styles and those sorts of things. It is a very inclusive definition, so I think that the definition of historic heritage has the potential to capture all relevant issues around sites of significance. It's not time bound, and really it's a matter of what the evidence about those sites or issues is. You know, I suppose one thing I did admit saying when dealing with the policy framework in Chapter 5, my understanding is that the two representative organisations representing various renowned interests in the district are pretty satisfied that it meets their needs. You'll obviously hear from them about that, but there is a good degree of agreement about that framework.
I'd like to question that meets the need, because there is the need of certainty that within the space, stage one, that the assurance or the certainty that those values will actually be picked up and addressed. And I would like to refer to the introduction, which I will be asking Mr. Mitchell when he's before us, is that he used the term as one of the most important areas in the operative is under consultation. Consultation, if you don't consult, well, those values just won't get picked up. Yet within the introduction section, the wording was changed quite significantly, which actually gives the applicant the choice as to whether or not they will consult. And I find that a bit of a contradiction in terms of the goal that has been set and across both chapters. So where would that sit in terms of a challenge that might?
Well, the language around consultation has been amended to reflect the statutory requirements of the Act that there is no obligation to consult. And that then raises an issue as to whether a district plan can impose a higher standard on applicants and my advice would be that it can't. It doesn't detract from the need to provide sufficient information about an application that impacts on the Te Awa values. And the only way you're really going to get that from a practical sense is through consultation. And I think most applicants are aware of that. And certainly the consequence, tracking through the way the Act works, of not consulting and not providing that information is that it's likely those parties will be directly notified as an affected person and have the opportunity to participate in resource consent applications. So NITA would be able to have a say in that manner. And I suppose the point I'm making is it's not necessarily possible for a plan to front-end every issue. And some of these, in my experience, the Te Awa Whenua issues are intensely site-specific and very dependent on facts and circumstances. So it's really about setting up the right framework for that engagement to play out
quite assured legally that that framework is in place in the stage, that's stage
the,
one.
Well, it's what's in the Act, and I don't see any real disjunct between what's in the Tunga Whenua chapter and what's in the Act. It supports the consideration of Tunga Whenua values within the Act and within the Act's framework.
Okay.
Reasonably comfortable about that from a legal perspective. As to the merits of the words, I think for those questions to Mr. Pickard.
Continuing on Tunga Whenua, but a different issue. The non-mapping of Wahi Tupuna and Taonga has been raised by several submitters in terms of being problematic in that the Chapter 5 extends considerable protection to those without knowing the sites that they refer to. So,
I'll just interrupt, because I'm sorry, this wasn't... It came in very late on Friday afternoon and I didn't have time to circulate it to my fellow commissioners, but my understanding, the remark was Park, the sole submitter that Commissioner Gilmore was referring to, have withdrawn their submission and their evidence on that matter.
I see.
So
in that case, don't bother answering.
It's no longer a live issue.
Were they the only ones?
Pretty much, I think. There may have been others, but...
I had a feeling it was more than remarks Park, but... Yeah.
Mm.
I can't cite the evidence.
Yeah.
The main evidence was the legal submission.
Yes.
Yeah, it's
yes.
Based on. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, to the extent it may still be a live issue, the my submission is not prejudice, the most significant prejudice on the parties, because if any further areas are to be identified, they need to be included through a notified proposal.
And at that point, you could.
Opportunity to split on the merits.
Otherwise, okay, thank you.
And just to clarify again, that setting, looking at the different values, you would definitely see that as, in terms of supporting the Act, would be better dealt with through the policy areas.
Well, it can never be exhaustive.
No.
But I think in terms of setting the framework by which and against which identified areas are identified and recognised, it makes sense.
Areas are different to the values, though. We can identify the areas, but the actual values within there are what should be within the provisions. And is more supportive and gives certainty to not only Tangata Whenua but also to the users of the plan.
Yeah, I have a clear understanding of the issue you're raising now. It'll be a mix of the policy framework and the identified individual values on the site, and it's really going to be a question of, do you include all the values in the policy framework, or do you have them more site specific? And I think inevitably it's going to need to be a mixture of the two. But what you want to make sure is that all values are recognised in some way so that a decision maker is able to take them into account.
Thank you.
Well, changing subject again. Can I ask you to please, Mr. Winchester, to turn to paragraph 6.37, where you're here making the case that it's not efficient, or the most appropriate way to interpret the Act, to distinguish between different areas in the context of landscape. The question I have for you is, in the event that the evidence that we hear is that different areas of the district have materially different landscape character, should would efficiency have to give way to the practical reality of addressing those differences?
Based on my understanding of the evidence, the framework which is proposed here enables those different characteristics to be addressed and assessed in individual circumstances. But it applied, what's being applied here is a policy framework, particularly around, and it's a change from what's in the Auckland District Plan around specific mapping and greater clarity as a consequence for plan users about where the lines are. And it's that approach which has been assessed in terms of Section 32 and efficiency and effectiveness, but the evidence on my reading of it is equally clear that the framework which has been set up in terms of the objectives and policies enables those different characters of different parts of the district to be assessed and recognised.
I think that the argument that we're going to hear is that at least in the Okatipu Basin, that the emphasis given to farming as a fundamental element of the character of this particular subset of the district is overstated and can't be sustained. And so the question that's rolling around in my mind and waiting to hear the evidence as to whether that proposition is or is not made out is, if it is made out, that the Wakatipu Basin is materially different in terms of the role of farming. Do the landscape policies need to recognise that?
Can I just add, can I just add to that, because I think it's a relevant part, and this was part of the Ayrburn evidence, which is 430, page 7. It said, the exceptional formulation where the ONL protection came from an Environment Court case relevant only to the Wakatipu Basin, and Section 32 analysis has not said why that should be extended. So I have some concerns along the similar line that if we've collapsed, if the plan has collapsed a variety of, well, ONL on both sides of the Crown Range into one. And then you say it can be assessed at this level, but if we have to put the wording of that that guides that assessment